I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is with the dazzling young writer Jonah Lehrer, still in his 20s. He's scientist enough to sail through oceans of brain science lab reports, but he's literature bug and humanist enough to remember that the study of man is still about you and me, the whole of us. Jonah Lehrer wrote, "Proust was a neuroscientist 2 years ago. It was a brief for art as the forerunner of scientific discovery about the brain." Jonah Lehrer's new book, How We Choose, which reads like a sequel, is about the limitations on reason and, by implication, the limitations on science itself. Jonah Lehrer, I count on you to give us us civilians a kind of notion of where neuroscience is going. Your first book, Proust Was a Neuroscientist, made the argument, a little contra science, but that artists get there first. And for all the miracles of brain science, people like Proust, even Walt Whitman, Emily Dickinson, Virginia Woolf, had a notion. The new book makes a connection, but I'd love you to say what it is.
I think the first connection is, if in the first book I was very much trying to reconcile art and science, these two things that at first glance seem like opposites. You know, artists tell fictions and scientists give us facts. I think this book is trying to reconcile another deep schism that has infected human culture for a long time, which is this divide between rationality and emotion. And for the most part, we've denigrated emotion and held up rationality. That's what separates. This goes back to Plato and the ancient Greeks. Rationality is what makes us human. It's the defining feature of human thought. It's what separates us from all the other lower animals. And I think that divide, just like the art and science divide, is largely fallacious. And I think if, when you look at the brain, there are all sorts of ways to collapse this ancient distinction, to realize that rationality isn't something to aspire to. That I think, as I talk in the book, pure reason, when you look at people who can't experience their emotions, pure reason isn't a gift from the gods. Pure reason's a disease. That people who have nothing but rationality inside their heads, they're pathologically indecisive. This is the work of people like Antonio Damasio. So one thing I tried to do in this book was shatter these categories of thought, which you know, go back from Plato to Freud. They've been the foundation of modern economics. They've, you know, informed cognitive science. And yet I think when you look at the brain, and this is the beauty of looking at the brain, it's the ultimate category buster. When you look at the brain, you see that these categories, these ancient categories, aren't quite as perdurable and real as we thought. G.K. Chesterton, I think, was right. The madman is not the man who has lost his reason. The madman is the man who has lost everything except his reason. Mm. And I talk about that in the book in terms of psychopaths, which is a very well-studied mental disorder. And what you see with psychopaths is that their problem is in a lack of rationality. Psychopaths, on average, seem to have higher than normal IQs. Their problem seems to be a defect of the emotional brain, that a brain area called the amygdala and its related pathways doesn't properly respond to human suffering. So when the rest of us, when normal people see someone else in pain, our brain lights up as if we were in pain. Adam Smith called this fellow feeling, and he believed, very controversially at the time, along with David Hume, that human morality was founded upon our emotions, on these subtle intuitions we had, on these feelings that compelled us to not hurt someone else's feelings. And this was the root of altruism, was root of fairness. Then people like Kant came along and said, oh no, it's, you can defend all morality in rational terms. And it turns out, when you look at the brain, that Adam Smith was onto something, and that what keeps us from hurting other people is the fact that hurting someone else makes us hurt. That we literally internalize the feelings of someone else. And that turns out to be a crucial component of what keeps us from hurting other people. And psychopaths, their problem isn't a lack of rationality. It's not that they don't understand Kantian morality. It's that they lack the thing underneath that. They lack the emotive impulse that keeps us from doing wrong in the first place.
So Adam Smith, in a sense, qualifies as one of those artists, yeah, who anticipated the findings of of brain science.
Yeah, he talks in the book he was most proud of wasn't his book on economics, it was his book on morality. And in that book, I think there's some great study to be written about how mirrors at the time were just becoming these, you know, hot new bourgeois things everyone put in their home. And I think Adam Smith has this great riff on mirrors. And I think mirrors, in a sense, became his metaphor for how people understand morality, and that we naturally mirror each other. And now you can talk about that in terms of mirror neurons, and we can talk about the circuitry behind it. But I think he was very sensitive to human behavior. And in that book, he really tries to unpack what goes through his mind and body when he's making a moral decision. And what he noted, like David Hume, was that these decisions don't seem to be rational. We're not thinking through the Kantian logic when we make a fair offer, or when we choose to be nice to someone, when we choose to give money to a beggar. He's got a great example of that. That these aren't rational decisions. We may rationalize them after the fact, but humans are rationalizers, not rational creatures. And that, I think, was Smith's big insight in his book. And that was really just simply a study from his own life, a study from his own listening, eavesdropping on his own brain. And so in that case, I think after the fact, 300 years later, we can go and talk about this in terms of the amygdala and the prefrontal cortex and brain areas like that. But I think we're really just giving an anatomy to what he called fellow feeling. Hmm.
These are such old and interesting questions, choice. I'm thinking of Tolstoy and War and Peace. It's all about why did Napoleon head east from Dresden? And he doesn't really know. And he doesn't really believe that Napoleon was in charge of the decision anyway. But I'm also thinking of one of my favorite novels, Henry James's Portrait of a Lady, in which Isabel Archer, new to England and being told that a young lady should be in bed at 10 o'clock, and she asks her hostess, Mrs. Touchette, to give her all the rules, a little annoyed. And Mrs. Touchette says, "So you can break them?" And she says, "No, so as to choose." And of course, the whole novel is about how she chooses the wrong husband, but the novel is still about her freedom to dope out that big question.
Yeah, I mean, I one of my favorite lines on the subject is a William James quote, which is, "My first act of free will shall be to believe in free will," which I think questions of free will and determinism, and those are inevitable questions when you talk about decision making. I think are in a sense beyond my pay grade, and I think beyond the findings of science, at least now and for the foreseeable future, I think these are lofty, lofty philosophical questions. There are no grander questions, and I think it's very tough. I think certainly science has eroded the standard Cartesian notion of free will, which is that I think, therefore I am, that I am in the driver's seat of my own brain. I think we found all sorts of ways you can suddenly tweak largely the unconscious brain. You can prime people, you can flash them stuff subliminally and affect their thoughts and behaviors and actions. So I think we've begun to erode a bit at the old-fashioned notion of free will. But I think the idea, even as we've done that, I think science has also come up with all sorts of ways to confirm, I think, what we all know to be true, which is that how you think can affect the way you think, that every thought you have feeds back onto your brain itself and changes the chemistry of it, can rewire your cells. There are some great studies, for example, of Buddhist monks, people who practice what's called metacognition every day, thinking about how they think. What you find is that these Buddhist monks show very abnormal is a loaded word, but very unusual brain activity, that they've been able to change brain areas like the amygdala that scientists thought were simply beyond the realm of control, that were simply fixed and set. They were primal, they were reptilian, they were areas we shared with all sorts of rodents and monkeys and all the rest. And yet it turns out that practiced deliberate thinking, conscious thought, can actually change the way these very primitive brain areas process the world. So I think even as we're, in a sense, eroding these conventional notions of free will that they go all the way back to, the ancient Greeks and the Enlightenment, I think at the same time we're also demonstrating the tremendous power of conscious thought, of the way we think can actually change the brain itself in very profound and, I think, surprising ways.
You write also especially about Tom Brady, under pressure, three receivers, five receivers, making an instant choice that is not irrational, but it's not a considered option exactly either, or pilots in a plane where all their hydraulic systems have been disabled, figuring out what is the chance of landing this baby safely and what in the world is going through their mind. I mean, nothing but choices, one a second, that they have to deal with. I take your sort of, forgive me, bottom line to be, in effect, that, was it Prester who said, chance favors the prepared mind, but that in the end, it is a decision made on things that you know, but you don't know how you know them. They're not reason at work.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the great themes of modern neuroscience has been the tremendous power of the unconscious. And I think the easiest way to demonstrate that is by talking about its simple processing power, as if it were a computer. And so when you look at the rational brain, the prefrontal cortex, this human brain area, which was greatly enlarging human evolution, is responsible for things like logic and philosophy and deliberate thought and conscious analysis. That's a magnificent Promethean brain area, and yet it can only handle about 7 bits of information, plus or minus, to at any given moment. So it's a very bounded machine. It's a very limited computer. The unconscious, in contrast, the emotional brain, this network of distinct brain areas scattered throughout the cortex, can process far more information, can take in all these facts. And if you're Tom Brady or a baseball player, that allows you to act on information that you may have no conscious awareness of. If you ask Tom Brady how he chose to throw to the receiver or the running back in the flat or the tight end, you know, in midfield, he'll say, I don't quite know. He just felt like the right guy to go to. He'll talk about it in terms of feeling, in terms of these subtle emotions that drive our behavior. And when you look at the brain, that's actually what you see is happening, is that the unconscious takes in all this information and then throws out emotions to kind of motivate us. The root of emotion is movere, which is to move. And what you see is these subtle emotional signals so subtle, we often don't register the emotion. We don't realize we're scared when we look at the, you know, wide receiver going deep. But these subtle emotional signals do drive our behavior. They're, in a sense, the output of the unconscious. They're the unconscious's way of telling us what to do based on all the information it's taken in and processed outside of conscious awareness. So on the one hand, that's been one of the great themes of modern neuroscience, is the fact that consciousness is just the tip of the iceberg, that the brain knows much more than we know, and that we're always taking in all this information, which allows us to swing in fastballs and find the open man in 3.5 seconds before we're sacked, and choose which cereal to buy in the supermarket. That all of our decisions are shaped by these emotional signals, which is why when you're cut off from these emotional signals, people become pathologically indecisive. That said, I think one of the other great themes of decision-making science in the last couple decades, and this goes back to Kahneman and Tversky, and I think lots of this recent work in neuroeconomics, which is that as wise as the emotional brain is, as profoundly intuitive as it can be, the fact that it knows more than we know, it can also be incredibly dumb, incredibly idiotic, and it's all about the situation. You put this same brain mechanism, which can be so wise in the football field, and all of a sudden you have it pick stocks, or you have it try to figure out which mortgage to get, and it's going to be just make the worst decision possible. So I think one of the things I tried to do in this book was construct a model of decision making that wasn't about we should always blink and trust our gut, or we should always be rational like Homo economicus, but to say the way you make decisions should depend on the kind of decision you're making. That you have to begin with the situation, diagnose the situation, be pragmatic about it, and then work backwards from that and try to tailor your thought process, which we're capable of doing, to the situation at hand.
This business of choosing the bad mortgages is the story of the day. I mean, we're living in sort of lemming city, whether it's Madoff investors or the mortgage market or Wall Street in general. I also hope we'll get to this question of why in our foreign policy we seem to be in a repetition compulsion pattern. I mean, doing things over and over again that we know don't work. But I'd like you to put the whole idea of how we decide in the context of all the books that a general reader like me and lots of us, you know, are sort of familiar with. George Lakoff, Don't Think of an Elephant, and Blink, as you say, but also Antonio Damasio on the emotional factor in choices, but the Cass Sunstein book on Nudge, which we've talked to him about. There's so much out there now. We're being bombarded with things like Steve Pinker's Blank Slate, The Real Nature of the Mind. Where are you coming from in that whole context? And what are the big, big ideas behind this whole splurge of interest in the brain?
One of the things motivating, I think, this whole new genre of books, that try to turn psychology, behavioral economics, and now neuroscience into kind of a genre of self-help, is the fact that for the first time, neuroscience is becoming a practical science. I think for most of the last few decades, we've made tremendous progress in terms of understanding how our synapses work, the kinase enzymes, and all these pathways inside the brain, and yet the science can often seem so abstract, so far removed from ordinary human experience. I think it's only the last couple of years, thanks to new tools, patch clamp, measuring individual dopamine neurons when monkeys get squirts of juice, and of course, brain scans, that I think we've been able to begin to apply this basic research to everyday questions, to how should I shop in the supermarket? How should I pick a car? Stuff like that. So I think a lot of what we're seeing is simply the fascination with, here's our own brain, this organ we've really not understood. It's been the black box, and finally the black box, to use that cliche, is being broken open. And I think that has inevitable consequences and inevitable interest for people who want to know how their mind works and how they can make it work better. In terms of how my book slots in, I think what I try to do is what books like Nudge, and it's a great book, and books like Blink and Predictably Irrational and that whole genre. Yes. They don't talk about the brain. They talk a lot about behavioral economics, about psychology. What I wanted to do is take that back to the brain, because I think in the end I think you don't want to be a gratuitous materialist. You don't just want to talk about the brain so you can talk about neurons. But I think you can often add a new dimension to the research, flesh it out to a new degree. And I think one example that is on the minds of everyone now, and we just mentioned subprime mortgages. Why 228 mortgages were so alluring, these things which,
yeah, why?
From a rational perspective, make no sense. You're paying far more in interest over 30 years. But I think it gets back to the temptation through one of these hardwired flaws in the emotional brain, which is that your emotions are great at dealing with now, but they just think about now. They're not so good at thinking about the future. So, for example, Cass Sunstein and Richard Thaler, this is Richard Thaler's work, they wrote Nudge, and he's shown that one way to get people to invest more in 401k is in their 401k is to simply ask them if you want to start saving 6 months in the future. And what that does is, this is work done by Jonathan Cohen at Princeton. You give people two Amazon gift certificates, one Amazon gift certificate for $10 they can have now, or in a week they can have an Amazon gift certificate for $15, or whatever the exact amount may be. And what you see is that, contrary to economic theory, these two choices, they activate two very different brain systems. That the emotional brain, your reward system, is activated by the option for now. You want it now. You want the gift certificate now. The gift certificate in a week is activates the rational brain. You think, oh, $15 is more than $10. And so these different patterns of activation lead us to think in different ways. And depending on which brain system shows more activation, you can predict people's choices pretty accurately. And I think this gets back to, bringing back to 228 mortgages, what this allows you to begin to understand is why this very bad idea, this very irrational mortgage, was so alluring. Because it basically potentiates, triggers their emotional brain. It front loads. You have a very low interest rate for the first 2 years, the next 28 years, but that's the distant future. The emotional brain isn't worrying about that. And so you've got this alluring offer, and you're not so good at contemplating the future. And so that I think was the mistake people made. And I mean, another big thing that I think brain research can help explain is credit card debt. It's hard to think of a more rational thing to do than to put stuff on your credit card that you can't quite afford. And then even if it's on sale, if you're paying 25% interest, and that's a standard interest rate for a lot of credit cards now, it's not going to be a very good deal a month from now when you have to carry this debt at a 25% interest rate. And the question is, why do people spend so much on the credit cards? And this gets back to, I think, a very interesting experiment that looked at how people make shopping decisions. What you find is, when people make shopping decisions, the thrill of getting something new. When you show them a new iPod or a new George Foreman grill or a new sweater, that activates a brain area called the nucleus accumbens, which secretes feelings of pleasure, makes us happy. We think about how happy that iPod will make us. Then you show them the price tag, how much that iPod costs, the sweater costs, and you see a brain area called the insula turn on. The insula generates negative feelings. It's often associated with things like disgust and bodily pain, and it turns out the pain of paying for something too. But then, when you have people pay with a credit card, the insula is less active than normal. And that's simply because the transaction's abstracted. Because they're not literally taking cash out of their wallet. Their wallet isn't lighter. They're just swiping a piece of plastic, and then in 30 days, it'll show up on a bill. But it literally finds this loophole in the brain, so to speak. The insula is less turned on, and so they spend too much money. They're less sensitive to how much money they're paying. And so the end result is they put stuff on their credit card that they wouldn't have bought if they had to pay with cash. So that to me is an example of why sometimes it's important to actually look at the brain itself, because this gives you a new perspective on why we do the things we do, on why, at first glance, running lots of credit card debt, and credit card debt is a huge problem in America right now. It's a very expensive thing to have, very high interest rates, and yet people seem to do it. And yet it's an incredibly popular way to run up expensive bills. And the question is why, and I think by looking at the insula, this funny little brain area, you can begin to understand why people do this thing, which seems very irrational at first glance.
Would you take a crack at some of the public choices that trouble me from this perspective? Dan Ariely writes, and you do too, about the fact that on a bet or on a risk, people are more concerned about loss than they are about gain. They're also easily egged into a position where war for our side looks like a good deal, and we'll hope for the best even when there's a very sound reason to say no, this is a bad deal and we've been here before. Knowing what we know about the brain, how do we fight its irrationality, its wrong choices over and over again?
Well, I think the simple answer is something like loss aversion, a very well-studied phenomenon, which is that people, losses hurt about twice as much as gains feel good, which have all sorts of big implications. For example, when people are valuing their stock portfolios, what you find is people are much more likely to sell stocks that have gone up in value because they don't want to make the loss tangible. They want to postpone the loss. Unfortunately, this means over time that they're stuck with a portfolio that's composed entirely of shares that are losing money. So a study by Terence Odian at Berkeley has found that the shares people sell outperform the shares they keep by 3.5%, which is a lot. And that's simply due to loss aversion. And the only way to avoid loss aversion is to know about it, is to take advantage of self-awareness, take advantage of the fact that we can think about how we think and say, wait, am I selling this stock because I should sell it or because I just don't want to take a loss on it or take a loss on this other stock? So in a sense, the first step, and really the only step, to avoiding these hardwired flaws, we can't help but think this way. This is just the way, in a sense, we've been programmed to feel and to process losses and gains. And it's very irrational. It's a hiccup. It's a mental hiccup. Is to be aware of it and to think about it before you make decisions which involve losses. So I think this is, again, where the secret recipe is can be a little deflating. It's that there is no secret recipe. You just have to be very attuned to your own flaws. You have to know these mistakes everybody makes unless you're thinking about them. In terms of foreign policy, I mean, obviously that's a very complicated question. I think that gets back to the fact that, I would tend to explain it. I think the last 8 years, we've had an administration which loves believing it's right, which comes in with these models of how things should go, of what they want to do. And then those models, once they're set in place, are very tough to disturb. What you find with the brain, and this is a very well-studied phenomenon, goes back to cognitive dissonance in the 50s. I think one of the great themes of social psychology, which is that the brain loves being right. And it's very tough, once the brain is convinced it's right, to prove it wrong. That we tend to filter the world to confirm what we already believe, to confirm our preconceived notions. This, I think, has all sorts of implications. It's why liberals watch MSNBC and conservatives watch Fox News. It's we constantly filter the world to justify what we think. And I think in terms of foreign policy, I think we all saw with devastating results, what can happen when that process isn't interrupted. How when you're convinced Iraq has WMD, all the evidence in the world to the contrary isn't going to dislodge that belief. I think especially in groups, foreign policy is made by committees and groups for the most part. I think, you know, you've got this basic, very, very, very basic mechanism that's at work in the brain, plus groupthink, plus the fact that groups naturally tend to conform to the loudest voice, to settle on an idea, and then it's very tough to dislodge that idea within a group. So I think you saw a bunch of cognitive flaws come together in a perfect storm. I talk in the book about, I think, a really, really well-done study by Philip Tetlock, a psychologist at Berkeley, who he studied political pundits, experts, and he followed them for, you know, almost 15 years, and he had to make predictions. He saw a couple hundred of these guys, you know, the talking heads you see on cable news. And he found that, you know, I think most people talk about a study in terms of the sheer failure of most experts. The fact that if you give experts three options, you know, will George Bush be reelected? You ask him questions about, you know, current events. So will George Bush be reelected? Will South Africa make a peaceful transition from apartheid? Will Quebec secede? Stuff like that. What you find is that on average, they perform worse in random chance. So a monkey throwing darts, you know, at these same questions will do better than most professional pundits. So that's, I think, the first lesson of a study. But then I think the more interesting lesson is that there are a few experts who did better, who did much better. And these were the experts in general who were able to, as Tetlock put it, eavesdrop on their own thoughts, who knew when they were stuck in the certainty trap, who knew when they were excluding evidence that contradicted what they may believe, who were sensitive to their own ideologies and made sure they didn't let these ideologies run amok. So that to me is a lesson we can all take away, that it's a very well done empirical study that shows, I think, just how dangerous this natural tendency can be, and why it's so important to, I think, deliberately take steps to act against it, which I think is something Obama, to his credit, seems to be doing. You know, very, very much modeling this team of rivals approach, which is trying to get as much dissonant information as possible and not being afraid of facts and voices that may contradict each other. Because that's what you want, you know, realizing that a very dangerous flaw for people in power is to settle into these ideologies and then naturally exclude information that contradicts them. So I'm very encouraged by, I think, the initial evidence that he seems to very much be encouraging this internal dissent.
John O'Leary, there's another big slice of this scientific story that everybody alludes to, but I haven't heard sort of traced to the source, and that is, Antonio Damasio writes about it, you write about it, George Lakoff writes a lot about it, but it is a brain science confirmation that we are, for all our contentiousness, a cooperative species. The altruistic gene, or the sympathetic instinct. What is the truth of this discovery? Who made it, and how do we get to apply it?
Well, you know, I think the modern narrative, for the most part, and I think the 20th century did little to dislodge this idea, was that we're Hobbesian brutes. We're these, you know, amoral, selfish, Darwinian creatures. We're buckets of selfish genes. We're just out for ourselves. And to the extent we're altruistic, you know, it's just we can explain away in terms of kin selection. It's just an anomaly. But that if left to our own devices, we'd all just eat each other, you know, and look out for ourselves, or maybe our first cousin, because they share 1/8 of our genes. A pretty cynical view of human nature. And what you find when you look at the brain is that that's actually not at all the case. And we come endowed with this very powerful set of moral instincts, which are rooted in the emotional brain, and that keep us from hurting each other. And as we talked about earlier, this gets back to Adam Smith's notion of fellow feeling, which is you put someone in a brain scan and you show them a scared face or a face of someone in pain, and their own brain lights up as if they were in pain, that it hurts us to hurt someone else. And I think one of the interesting ways to look at this is in terms of psychopaths, people who lack this set of moral emotions. And they are Hobbesian brutes. They are missing this very basic set of moral instincts, and that's why they're much more likely to kill someone else in order to accomplish a goal, what's known as instrumental violence. So I think, you know, in a sense, it's uplifting, this idea that because we're social primates, because we had to learn to live in a group, because we never lived by ourselves, we had to develop these hardwired notions and instincts that keep us from hurting each other. You know, we can't just kill each other. We can't murder each other. That's no way to live in a group. We had to learn to get along. And so this set of moral emotions is, in a sense, the end result of that basic mechanism, of that need, the fact that we had to learn to live in tribes way back in the Pleistocene era. Now, that said, I think obviously humans aren't perfectly moral creatures. And there are all sorts of ways to kind of get around these instincts or to rationalize them away after the fact. So I talk in the book about some work done by Brian Greene at Harvard University, who he studies what's known as the trolley problem, which is, it's a well-studied philosophical thought puzzle where, let's say you're the driver of a trolley and you notice that ahead of you on the tracks are five workmen on the track. And unless you turn the wheel, you will run over these five people. They will all die. Or if you turn the wheel to go on the right track, there's one worker and you will kill him. What do you do? And what you find is that when you ask people this question, about 95% will say, oh, I'll turn the wheel to the right. I'll just kill one man. It's better to kill one person than five people. Simple arithmetic and makes perfect sense. However, now let's try the puzzle again, except this time you're on a footbridge overlooking the trolley tracks. And what you see is that this runaway trolley is on a track, and if it doesn't stop, it'll kill five people, but it can't stop because it's a runaway trolley. But right next to you is a very large man, a fat man. And you notice that if you push him off the footbridge and he's leaning over, so just take a little shove, he would fall into the tracks and block the trolley, and five men would be saved. The five workers would be saved. So what do you do? Now what you find is about 95% of people say, oh, I would never push the man. I couldn't do that. And so this is a clear example. This Green calls it a personal moral situation because this activates our moral circuitry because we have to literally push the man. It's an act of personal violence. That suddenly feels wrong, whereas just turning the wheel, that doesn't activate the same circuitry. And you look at this in a brain scan and you see different patterns of activation. From a philosophical perspective, it seems like the same puzzle. It's 5 versus 1. It should lead to the same rational outcome. And yet because one scenario activates this innate moral circuitry and one doesn't, people respond very differently. So this is a neat way, I think, of exposing how we've got these very innate moral instincts, and yet they're fragile, and yet it's very easy to kind of step around them, to get around them, and to rationalize them away.
Who gets credit as the sort of Louis Pasteur or Charles Darwin of the moral instinct, the hardwired social altruistic impulses in the species, hardwired?
It's tough to just name one person. I think there's been a confluence of work. I think DeWall has done some great work on primates. I tell the story in my book of one of his experiments where you set up monkeys and you train monkeys to, if they pull on chain A, they get lots of food, of a food they really enjoy. If they pull on chain B, they get less of a food they don't like quite as much. So naturally, of course, all the monkeys learn to pull on chain A. And so you train them and you let this habit solidify for a couple weeks. And then one day a monkey pulls on chain A, and you see the monkey across the hall. After this monkey pulls on chain A, the chain that gives it lots of the food it loves, this monkey gets shocked. So they see the monkey get electrical shock. It screams out in pain. And what do these monkeys do? They all stop pulling on chain A for several days. Most monkeys stop pulling on chain B for several days too. One monkey starved itself for 12 days. And the question is why? And it's because they were so scared. They didn't want to hurt another monkey. That it hurt them so much to watch this other monkey shriek out in pain when they pulled this chain that was enough to get them to literally starve themselves for 2 weeks. I think you can do experiments like that. And these experiments have been done for a couple decades that I think got people thinking about, God, these other primates, we've been thinking about them as such brutes, just like us. And yet they seem very, very responsive to the pain and suffering of others. And then I think it's in the last couple years, work like that done by Brian Greene, which we just talked about, which I think is located this instinct in the brain. I think John Haight at University of Virginia has done some really great work on showing how you can give people ethical puzzles, and they come up with these very strong reasons why it's wrong for people to do certain stuff, why it's wrong to hurt someone else or to sleep with your sister or to clean your toilet with an American flag. And yet once you strip away the reasons, all the rational reasons they may have for clinging to this belief, the belief is still there. What this suggests to him is that our morality isn't about rational reasons. And we come up with these reasons after the fact in a very lawyerly way. We're defending these instincts, but at the core is this instinct, is this emotion. And so even when all the reasons are taken away, we still have the feeling. We still know it's wrong to do this or to hurt them or to clean your toilet with an American flag, even though we can't explain why, we just know it's wrong. So I think it's been a large confluence of lots of scientists who are slowly chipping away at, I think, you know, the selfish gene idea, the idea that we're just out for ourselves, that we are just Hobbesian brutes.
You know, I think the thread in your two books that I've read, Jonah, is this notion that you can study science as best a sort of civilian can and not be totally seduced by it as the ultimate answer. Your first book about Proust, was a neuroscientist, really argued that artists get there first and they get there deepest and most memorably. The argument of the new book might just be, I would summarize it as saying in effect that much as we know about the brain, we discover that art and love and prayer and even the lessons, the moral lessons in religion may well be the abiding truths.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the recurring themes of the book is I love sprinkling in quotes from everyone from Beckett to Adam Smith, people who had no access to fMRI machines, but yet, or Chesterton, which we talked about earlier, and yet articulated these very profound truisms about the way our brain works. So that absolutely is, I think, a consistent theme in both books. The fact that very sensitive observers of their own mind tend to have minds that work better. So in the same way, political pundits who are more sensitive to the way they think, who can really flex these metacognitive muscles, who think about how they think constantly, they end up thinking better. And I think a lot of this knowledge we don't need brain scans for. I think it's the stuff we know intuitively. I think what brain scans and modern neuroscience are so good at doing is coming along after the fact and really clarifying our theories, constraining our theories, showing us, you know, that may feel true, but it's not quite true, stuff like that. But I think for the most part, most of the ideas I talk about in this book and use science to explain and justify, these aren't new ideas. People have known for a long time, long before we knew how dopamine neurons work and the prediction error signal and all the rest, all those details I talk about, we knew that experts tend to learn best by studying what they got wrong. Then we look at how experts learn. They really learn by looking at their mistakes. And this can be an unpleasant way to live, because who wants to get home after a long day's work and think about all the stuff you messed up that day? And yet, you know, that tends to be a very effective way to learn. As, you know, Beckett said, fail, fail better, fail, fail better. You know, just it's that process of realizing that we all make mistakes, we all fail. And yet what great experts tend to do, and this is I think a big thread of expertise, is see mistakes as an opportunity to learn. You know, as Bob Dylan put it, there's no success like failure, and failure is no success at all. So I mean, obviously, we don't need neuroscience to teach us that. I think neuroscience can show us that, can place a greater emphasis on that, can show us, can help explain why this works, and thus maybe make us more attuned to it and more sensitive to it, and really focus our efforts on learning from our mistakes. And I think you can talk about the work of Carol Dweck at Stanford, who she shows how teaching kids about how their brain actually learns, shaping, can really alter the way kids learn and can allow them to learn much more effectively.
I'd forgotten that point, but it struck me powerfully when I came across it in your book, that the great ones have a doctrine, really, of learning from their mistakes. Certainly, Ted Williams hit that way and cataloged pictures that way. And scientists do it, too. How do the rest of us, study, even at the end of the day, how do we make the next round better?
Well, I talk about it in terms of a variety of domains. I talk about it in terms of a backgammon player after every match. Even matches he wins, he goes back and looks at all the moves he did badly. I talk about a soap opera director who, after a day of shooting, you know, he gets home. It's worked a 16-hour day. He gets home, puts in the raw tape for that day, and forces himself to make a list of 30 things he did wrong. 30 mistakes so minor no one else has noticed them. And yet he forced himself to catalog them. Tom Brady, when Tom Brady watches game tape for hours every week, he's not watching. He's not looking for the passes he did well. He's looking for the passes he missed, for the open man he didn't find. To get back to the work of Carol Dweck, she's shown with second graders that simply altering a single line of praise, when you praise kids for being smart or praise them for trying hard, that single line of praise has dramatic effects. And kids who think they're smart, who are praised for being smart, they want to, you know, keep that self-identity. So they're less likely to take the harder test. They're less likely to make mistakes, to put themselves in situations where they're going to fail, because that's inevitable, because this test is too hard for them. On the other hand, kids who get praised for trying hard, they're much more interested in taking it hard test and then looking at their mistakes and trying to learn from their mistakes. And what you see over the course of a few months is that kids who are praised for trying hard end up doing much better on the same test than kids who are praised for being smart, simply because they're more likely to learn from their mistakes. They're in that separate, they've got a different way of thinking about learning. It just turns out being much more effective. So I think, as you know, the single piece of advice is simply we need to think about how we think about learning, and see mistakes as the inevitable component of learning, that you can't learn at a very fundamental level unless you get stuff wrong. And so not to fear our mistakes, not to loathe them, not to be so scared of making them, but to realize that we have to, in a sense, celebrate them, that they are an inevitable component of learning and you can't learn without them. And that's true at the very most fundamental level of learning in your brain cells. Your brain cells learn through what's called a prediction error mechanism, which is they literally make predictions and then study the mismatch between what they predicted and what actually happened. So they catalog their mistakes. They learn how to do right by studying what they got wrong.
Jonah Larry, you remind me of a conversation I had probably 10 or a dozen years ago with Antonio Damasio, brain scientist, and I was desperately afraid as he got deeper and deeper into neurons and pathways and mapping the whole bloody brain that he was going to take the mystery, the darkness, the joy of not knowing out of life. I think you restore that, what some scientists ridicule as wallowing in the mystery. We probably will be wallowing in the mystery as long as the species lasts. What do you think?
Oh, I'm a wallower.
So am I.
I think one of the things that fascinates me most about the brain, and the reason I love writing about it and learning about it, is that, in a sense, the more we know about it, the more mysterious it becomes. You know, in a sense, I think 20 years ago you talked to scientists and they assumed that, oh, you know, we're making so much progress. In 20 years, we'll have consciousness solved. We'll know, you know, this used to be called the bridging principle, the magical phenomenon that somehow turned squirts of neurotransmitter and, you know, electrical transmissions between cells. Somehow we know how that gave rise, how these 3 pounds of gelatinous flesh gave rise to the mystery of subjective self-consciousness, subjective experience, the red of a red painting, the apple of an apple, the taste of an apple, the, you know, all the things that define our first person experience, that we'd somehow know how, you know, the body gave rise to the mind, how the water of the brain gave rise to the wine of the mind. And, you know, I think now no one even asks that question anymore. We don't even know how to ask that question, let alone have an answer. So in a sense, I think we're farther away now from understanding this most fundamental of questions of modern neuroscience than we were 20 years ago, in the sense that we're not even begging the question anymore. We don't even know how to ask it. And so to me, I think one of the great ironies of modern neuroscience is that it's, you know, dismantling our brain, deconstructing it, understanding it at this very fundamental level, the level of synapses and cells and ion channels and all the rest. And yet the one reality you can't describe, the one reality you can't describe in terms of these neurons and synapses and material phenomena, is the only reality we'll ever know, which is the reality of subjective experience, the reality of self-consciousness, because we feel like more than just the sum of ourselves. So in that sense, I think there will always be this wonderful mystery, you know, the mystery of how come this exists, how come this here now is real to us, that I think science just won't be able to penetrate, at least not with the tools and methods it has now and in the foreseeable future. So I don't worry too much about there not being a place to wallow, that there not being a mystery to explore and for novelists to write about and for all of us to celebrate.
Which reminds me, my last question really, you stand with the novelists, the poets, the musicians, the mystery mongers in a way who deal imaginatively with all of that scene. Who, you've talked about a lot of scientists, who are the artists, writers, imaginative folk in our world today that best show us ways to deal with our consciousness?
Yeah, I think you can rattle off all the great novelists of the 20th century, and I think they've all shown us how our mind works. Whether you're talking about Philip Roth or Saul Bellow, or you know, I mean, we've had no shortage of great novelists. I think, in particular, I think one in the last few decades, we've also had great novelists who have, I think, shown us how to deal with this new knowledge we have, this new knowledge of the fact that we are just, as John Updike put it so memorably in one short story, sacks of walking upright tripe. And you know, to deal with this new knowledge that there is no ghost in the machine, so to speak, that we are just the hum of the machinery. And so I think, you know, there are novelists like Ian McEwan, Updike certainly up there, Richard Powers. I can rattle off my people on my bookshelf. You know, I think what these people allow us to do is to put this science in a new context, to kind of understand by exploring it through the prism of fiction, of a novel. They allow us to I think understand its true implications and its full implications. I ended Proust by talking about Ian McEwan's novel Saturday, this really magnificent novel about a neurosurgeon, where he followed a neurosurgeon for a couple of years, and there are some beautiful meditations on I think the paradox of modern neuroscience, which is how this organ gives rise to consciousness, this cinema of consciousness. So, you know, that I think is what we'll always need novelists for, and art for, period. That in the end, I think the science will always be bracketed by this profound mystery, the mystery of consciousness and conscious experience. And so I think, thank God, we have artists to help us explore not just our mind in everyday life, not just be the Virginia Woolfs of the world telling us what it feels like as we go out to buy flowers for a dinner party, but to also understand the implications of this research, to actually really consider the facts. People like Richard Powers, who I think I mentioned, Richard Powers reads Nature and Science every week, and always looking for new science to kind of transpose into fiction. So I think it's, you know, the need for, you know, great artists is, in a sense, more than ever. It's not enough anymore just to understand how we think in the way a modernist novelist struggled to, you know, compress consciousness, the stream of consciousness on the page. I think now we need artists to not just do that, but to also help us understand what the science is telling us and its full implications.
Joan Allera, it's a joy to read your book, How We Decide, and it's a joy, too, to listen to you in conversation on Open Source. Thank you enormously for everything you do.
Thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Joan Allera, with help from our Brown undergraduate intern, Hannah Olson. Please join the conversation on How We Choose on your own head as the charioteer riding the horses of your emotions, and tell us how it all comes out, the art and science of it, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thanks for joining in.